Welcome to Political Rewind. If you're just listening to the NPR News Break, Dow Industrial's up 129 points. Galloway, maybe we should have been day traders.
I gotta go check my 401k.
There you go. Jim Galloway, the political writer, lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here as he always is on Friday and Mondays as well. You read him in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. Jim, always like to ask whether you can give us a brief preview of what's coming up on Sunday.
Well, I was moderating an Atlanta mayoral forum on Wednesday, and I got the candidates on the topic of corruption in City Hall.
And you got some great comments out of them, and I hope that later on in the show you'll give us a little more. People should read the column, but you'll give us a little bit of what they had to say about it. It was newsworthy. Jackie Gingrich Cushman is with us as well. It's been a while, and we're really glad to have you back. Jackie's a conservative, a columnist, blogger, and thinker about politics in Georgia and beyond. She comes by it honestly. Her father, of course, was Speaker of the House, is the former Speaker of the U.S. House,
Newt Gingrich. And is now the spouse of a U.S. ambassador.
Yes.
To the Vatican, of all places.
He's been training very hard to be the trailing spouse.
Jackie, let's be honest.
It's going to take a lot of training. It's going to take a lot. We'll see how he does. A lot of training going into that.
So do you have any trips to visit the Vatican yet on the calendar?
Well, not yet. Our oldest child is a senior in high school this year, so we're very busy with that. But we're thinking maybe in the summer after graduation that we'll head over. But
wow, how
yeah.
exciting.
Very excited for
Well,
them.
Congratulations to you, to your family on that one. And Senator Nan Orrick, who represents the city of Atlanta, Democrat in the Senate. Nan, how many terms have you served at this point?
I have been privileged and honored to serve 10 terms in the House and 5 terms in the Senate.
Yeah. That's so your first were elected to the House. What would it have been?
I was sworn in 87.
87.
The year that John Lewis was sworn into the U.S. Congress.
30 years.
Congratulations.
That's right.
That's pretty remarkable.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about a number of state and national political issues before we do, just very briefly, we've, of course, ended our fall fund drive yesterday afternoon, and we were very involved with raising money, asking you who listen to this show to become contributors to our work. And I just really quickly want to tell you how grateful those of us on the Political Rewind and Two-Way Street teams are for your contributions. We set some pretty good records in terms of your response. So thank you from Olivia Rheingold, from Tyler Morris, our engineer, Jenny Ament, Tom Faust, all of us who work together on Two-Way Street and Political Rewind. We're grateful for your contributions. All right, Jim Galloway, let's start with a story that just broke. You broke it. You guys broke it on Politically Georgia, which is your new premium website for political news. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's $3.99 a month.
you know, the more you well say done. That, you're going to end up having to be an underwriter if you're not careful. but this is it broke at about 1:05. Ariel Hart and James Saltzer, two of your colleagues. What basically?
Right. Now, this was and it was initially broken by Project Q, I think. In Atlanta, they sent out the first word. There was a House Study Committee on Healthcare yesterday, in which we had Betty Price, wife of former Congressman Tom Price,
and a state rep
and
from
a
Roswell,
state representative from Roswell, wonder out loud if the state has the power to quarantine people with HIV.
The quote is from her. Quote, and I don't want to say the quarantine word, but I guess I just did. Is there an ability, since I would guess that public dollars are expended heavily in prophylaxis and treatment of this condition, so we have a public interest in curtailing the spread, what would you advise, or are there any methods legally that we could do that would curtail the spread?
Yeah, it seems a good 30 years out of date.
I was going to say 30 years. I was on the AIDS statewide commission to craft AIDS legislation with George Hooks chairing that under Governor Joe Frank back in 89. And that's the kinds of things that were coming out in hearings around the state. Let's tattoo people's wrists.
And to be fair, I mean Betty Price has a reputation for being very blunt spoken, and it's often without a filter. It's not out of character, but it was an interesting divergence.
I'll add one more point to that. She's a doctor.
Yeah.
She's a medical doctor, and for that level of ignorance to be displayed by a person who is a trained doctor, there's a very robust, led by Dr. Melanie Thompson, there's a very robust effort going on in Fulton County specifically to address the high rates, and there are all sorts of things that are being done in other states that require policy changes, such as syringe exchange, that have been steadfastly resisted here.
Jackie, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think the senator is exactly right. It's not only out of date, it's very sad. I mean, when you think about out of date, it was in a time when we knew so much less than we do now. And to me, it's very heartbreaking because I actually have friends with HIV that I'm very close to and I never think about, I never think about that. So to me, it's really heartbreaking. And trust me, I understand being unfiltered, but I think sometimes you need to actually stop and think a little bit before you say things.
It's we should point out that there are any number. Nan pointed to one or two of them. There are a number of some of our most important nonprofits in Georgia that are working on HIV. Alicia Phillip, the president of the Community Foundation, has been involved in this, and she and her colleagues point out that there are zip codes in the city of Atlanta, primarily at the south side of the city, that have higher rates of HIV infection than some of the countries in Africa being the places where
we're going.
Right. This is the English Avenue, Vine Street area.
And let me say that if we were to take the simple step of expanding Medicaid and expanding the number of people that have a medical home and medical coverage, that's where you get both your your preventive approach in a setting from professionals and also how you manage your disease if you are infected. But this state has not done that, and we leave all these people out here uninsured, and we have our senators voting to weaken the health system that we have.
Well, as Jim pointed out, Betty Price has always been outspoken. We will have to, for the time being, accept this as a statement that reflects her thinking on the subject. But Jackie, we have no way. We don't know that she is about to introduce legislation to propose this sort of thing. And I would imagine it's doubtful she would. But it does give us a window into how she thinks. Fair enough? All right.
Yes. And she has an opponent that's going to qualify against her for the race next year for that seat. So it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds.
All right. Jim Galloway, Mark Rountree of Landmark Communications, a panelist on this show with some regularity, released a poll this week of the Georgia Republicans gubernatorial contest. It was no surprise and really kind of reaffirmed conventional wisdom that Casey Cagle seems to be at this stage early on, 7 months before the primary, the man to beat. But it was second place that was really interesting.
Yeah, Hunter Hill, and we're still talking far behind.
Right.
Hunter Hill, and then close behind him, Brian Kemp, and behind him, Michael Williams. This is what we consider basically your baseline poll.
Yeah, it's a benchmark.
It's a benchmark, and what happens is, in polls, often the numbers aren't as important as the movement. And so what you do is you try to lay that original thing down, and then in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 months, you do another one, and you see who has moved.
Yeah, that's just to expand on that. I don't want to go off on the mayor's race, but a similar instance of what you're talking about is the polls on the mayor's race are either reliable or not, but they consistently have had a trend that shows Mary Norwood significantly out front. And so you're suggesting essentially the same thing here. This gives us an opportunity in October to start to watch progress of any candidate in the race.
Exactly.
Right. I don't think, Jim, I can't remember off the top of my head, you probably know. What are the undecideds in that? governor's race?
You know, I would have to let me see if I can.
Because that to me, I think there's a very large number of undecideds, which
absolutely,
which I thought was interesting in some ways because the race isn't really on yet. They declare, but they're not really out there. But also, Cagle does have a really solid stance, but I think he's at 35. So if you still have a huge number of undecideds, there's still a lot of people kind of sitting there waiting to figure out what's going to happen. So I think, to your point, this is kind of where he is. I mean, more than likely, it'll go to a runoff with this many candidates.
Yep. Go ahead.
And I think that makes a big difference. So the question becomes, who's the number two? Who gets that number two spot? I think Cagle is going to think he's, you know, pretty solidly in at least one of those two spots. And the question is, who's the other? But since it is a long way until May, anything can happen.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's exactly right. But again, one of the reasons I thought it was interesting to discuss for just a few minutes, Nan, is what it tells us perhaps, at least, what do you got the numbers?
44% undecided.
Okay, so virtually half. Virtually half of Republican people, Republicans who are likely to vote, as I assume what Roundtree used as his screen. But Nan, it does, nevertheless, we're acknowledging this is a poll that's just a starting point.
Sure.
But if I were Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State of Georgia, the fact that Hunter Hill, a far less well-known guy in the legislature, seems to be breathing down his neck, I don't think it would make me frightened, but it would sure tell me I better kick my campaign into a new gear.
Well, and he just got another court reprimand for some of his latest antics as Secretary of State in charge of our electoral process. The NAACP sued against him again, got a court order on his trying to narrow the window in which people can register
It was a legal question of whether a runoff, whether you have to, you have to, you can't vote in a runoff if you're not registered before the original race, say in March.
So, Jack, go ahead. First you, and then I want to ask you a question.
But I do think it says, if you look at the top number is 35% for Cagle, 44% undecided, which is bigger than the top candidate.
Right.
What this says to me is there's room for someone who's not currently well-known. Because if people were excited about those that are currently well-known, which really, if you look across the state, it's really Cagle and Kemp. I mean, Hunter Hill has that following in Atlanta. If you're outside of Atlanta, you probably don't know who he is, so you might have even answered his name because he didn't know who he was. So I do think this says that there's an opening, which I think is not surprising considering what's happening around the rest of the country.
Let me start with you on a question on this, Jackie, and then I'd love to hear everybody offer what they think about this.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that a dynamic that could develop that could either work for or against Brian Kemp is that Stacey Abrams has had a long-running feud, and more than a feud, I mean a legal battle with Kemp over registering new voters, her effort to get new voters registered back in the 2014 election cycle. It strikes me that Stacey Abrams, who will certainly be a potent candidate for governor, it is likely that she will continue to pound away at Kemp as part of her effort to win the primary. She'll go after him, whereas, and maybe I'm really, really thinking too deeply or thinking too much about this, whereas there's no other, I'm not sure that there's any other Republican candidate who's going to be the target of Democrats early on because they got to fight with each other.
Oh, and look, if you're Brian Kemp or Stacey Abrams, that's a mutually beneficial dynamic there because you're trying to limit the race in voters' minds to two candidates.
Yeah.
Right. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would point out that Kemp is putting out fundraising letters, hammering on Stacey Abrams and branding her as a wild-eyed radical. And at the same time, he's using the power of his office to investigate the new Georgia project. They came up, by the way, with a clean slate after an investigation has been running since 2014.
Well, they identified something like 60 registrations that were illegal were counterfeit.
Well, yeah, I took issue with the AJC headline, which talked about These outside contractors, questionable. Did they misregister or make errors in registering about 60 people? But they said the New Georgia project was cleared of any charges. But he uses her as his foil to continue to hammer on these dangerous Democrats.
But Bill, I would say just if we go back to this poll, what I think the important thing here is that Kegel's at 35, everybody else is in single digits, and you haven't really seen any coalescing of the Trump vote or the Trump voters.
Yeah.
And you haven't had...
Interesting.
You've got Brian Kemp and certainly Michael Williams both
want that
they're,
vote.
They're both angling for that, and I suspect Hunter Hill.
No, I was going to agree with Jim. I think it is a very mutual beneficial relationship for both Stacey Abrams and for Brian Kemp, because if they talk about the other side, they, to their own base, both of them look stronger, right? So this is going to help both of them. But again, it's a long way. I think they're clearly with 44% undecided. There is, I think, room for another candidate. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
Galloway, though, I have to point out, aren't you glad when you hear a Democrat say that she took issue with a headline in the AJC? That dispels the notion that you're a liberal media organization.
Oh, yeah, but she's a plant.
I've never had that problem.
Let's one more item on the governor's race. Jackie, it sort of goes right with what you're saying about room for another candidate. Michael Williams has managed for a second time this week to get himself in the news, although the first time he's in the news this week, we discussed this on the show Wednesday, it was because he was the first Republican candidate to come out and say bump stocks are actually a good thing because they are they harm the aim of a shooter, and the Las Vegas massacre would have been much worse if the bump stock hadn't kept him from aiming. And now he was going to auction off a bump stock to a contributor. Now he's in the news because the Cherokee teacher, who was in some trouble because she told a couple of kids who were wearing Trump T-shirts, Make America Great T-shirts, to turn them inside out, he went after her even though she apologized. The principal said, look, she didn't do anything wrong.
She was suspended. No, she was suspended.
She was suspended.
Well, okay, all right, go ahead. I apologize. But he went up there, held a demonstration. He's continued to call her out, and now she's resigned from her
right. And of course, and he is claiming credit for chasing her out of the classroom.
Right
now,
for being the first guy to endorse Trump in the Georgia Senate.
You can, but let's stick with the classroom thing. I mean, this was a woman, an experienced teacher, a pretty good math teacher, so far as I've heard. And she was disciplined within the system.
Yeah.
It wasn't enough for a politician outside, so he went after her. That's that might sell in some sections of the GOP primary, but not altogether. And it certainly is not going to sell in a general election.
But Jackie, is there a Trump? There clearly is a Trump base here, and it is. Jim points out they're waiting to coalesce around someone. Michael Williams seems to be the guy who wants to take on the Trump mantle and run that kind of campaign built around, if I'm outrageous, I'll get headlines.
Well, clearly that's what he's doing. The question is, based on the polls, it doesn't look like it's at least not yet working. We'll have to wait and see if it actually does. But Jim, if you're a candidate for a statewide office, you have no name recognition, and you're trying to garner attention, earned media is a great way to do it.
All right. I want to get a break in when we come back. I want to talk briefly about the Kennesaw state situation with the cheerleaders who took a knee during the national anthem a few weeks ago. It's evolved, and we should probably give a few minutes to that. So let's take a break on Political Rewind. We'll be back in a minute.
If you supported GPB during our fall fund drive, thank you. We're already putting your dollars to work to deliver the service you've come to expect and enjoy from GPB. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive, your online contribution now will still make a difference. Please take a couple of minutes now to go to our website, gpb.org, and click the green donate button at the top of the page. Thanks so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
Jim Galloway, you and I, and I think probably Jack, well, Nan for sure, Jackie probably, we've all known Sam Olens for a very, very long time. We followed his career, covered him when he was Cobb County Commission Chair, when he became AG. And as I mentioned quickly on the show the other day, Olens finally decided, probably I've had enough of partisan politics in that AG's job. I'm going to go be a university president where life is so much safer and calmer. And this KSU cheerleading thing has blown up in his face. And even at his investiture yesterday, he found himself faced with demonstrators.
Yeah. He didn't mention the controversy in his investiture's address, but he did have KSU students take a knee during the playing of the national anthem.
Nan, where do you see? Here's the dispute, as you know, I'm sure. They took a knee on one Saturday, or maybe Friday night, I'm not sure when the game was played. The following week, they were not on the field, the cheerleaders, for the playing of the national anthem.
That's right.
Olin said that didn't have anything to do with him, that the athletic department had previously made a decision that the cheerleaders should be given an opportunity to make a big entrance after the anthem. People were skeptical of that. And then these texts were obtained by an open records request, which the AJC had the other day, that suggested that Sheriff Neil Williams in Cobb County and Earl Earhart, as one of
the state representative from Cobb County,
very powerful representative, they at least congratulated each other on getting to Olens to make him decide this. Now, we don't know if they were congratulating themselves and taking credit for something that was happening anyway, really, but this is not good for Olens.
And the Board of Regents is
now investigating.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the real news hook here.
That's right. And, you know, I don't know when people will ever get it straight in their heads. Emails are findable and searchable. And what you put in an email, guess what, is going to be public knowledge if somebody wants to make it public knowledge.
Unless you're a state lawmaker like yourself.
That's right, that are insulated.
Because you have exempted yourself from the Open Records Act.
I probably voted against that. But
by the way, these were, according to the AJC, these were texts.
These were texts.
Now, what's interesting to me about that is
through the Cobb County Sheriff's Department.
I did not know that texts were subject to Open Records.
Okay, so let me just look at the same speech I gave my children in middle school. Everything you say and do can be obtained by somebody, so be careful, okay? Are we all clear now? Because that's the reality of today's world.
That's
no matter
it.
Where you are or what's happening, someone can record you or take a picture or, you know, convey what's happening.
But I will I'll tell you that there's a little cultural thing here going on. I mean, Sam Olens is, I think, the fourth president to serve KSU over 5 decades.
That's right.
And
That's right.
For the longest period of time, KSU or Kennesaw College in its original inception was a junior college. It was kind of an isolated institution, and within the Cobb County Republican world, there's a sense of possession.
That's
that
right.
This
well, they
ours.
Put all the money into it
that
to build it
ours.
Up.
This is ours. This is ours. And so it did not surprise me at all to see Earl Earhart, who's chairman of the House Subcommittee, Appropriations Subcommittee on Universities Spending, get involved there, or Neil Warren, for that matter.
Yeah. Do we think that Sam Olens is in trouble? His job is in jeopardy over this?
Well, you know, let's point out that they were berating their faculty and staff to attend yesterday's ceremonies. To officially bring him on board.
Apparently,
it was a very thin crowd. They said that only half of the seats were filled, and that there's within that college community, his standing seems a bit shaky. They can't fire him, but the public opinion, and there was a long critique, you know, moving him in there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think this is you got to consider this is a job again. 4 presidents in 5 decades. Mm-hmm. This is he's going to have this job a while. He's got a good bit of time to make the ground up.
I thought Karen Handel was in town and made an appearance at the Marietta Kiwanis Club the other day, and the Marietta Daily Journal did a piece on a number of this comments she made about various important issues. I thought her comments about this KSU situation were interesting. She said, if I were a parent, I'd want my son or daughter to be respectful of our flag and the veterans who have literally shed blood and tens of hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost. She goes on in that vein. But then she says, I have all the respect in the world for an individual who wants to protest. There are plenty of other ways of doing it. The reason I read that, Jackie, is this could be an opportunity for a Trump-style Republican to pound the protesters into the ground. She was very careful, and I wonder if it reflects a feeling among some legislators like Karen Handel that this is a more nuanced, that the voters see this as a more nuanced issue than Trump does.
So I'm going to push back a little bit because Karen, in my opinion, is she's pretty direct. Okay, so when she talks, she usually talks very directly, similar to what we talked about earlier with Betty Price. So I think this is what she really believes. So I think it's less a weighting of what she sees around her and more of what she believes. But I could be wrong. I'm just basing on my knowledge of her. But I think she's exactly right. So I do have my child is a cheerleader. I would like for her to be respectful to the flag. But I do think there is a lot of value in protest. I do think that there's a lot of value in being able to speak your mind. The question becomes, how do you do it in a way in which is most effective, and how do you make sure that what you're protesting is heard versus the controversy around it?
Well, I think there has been a deliberate effort from Trump on down to distort the meaning of this protest. The protest, I think, has been, first of all, very successful. It's Take a Knee has spread across the country as a symbolic way to demonstrate resistance to the incredible levels of police violence. I think that those cheerleaders, if you read their personal statements, they grew in that moment when they decided to do that. And if you look at the pictures of the NFL players, they are kneeling and their hands are across their heart.
So, Nan, let me ask you. Let me push back a little myself on something. It is certainly true that in some contexts the protest is growing. Not in the NFL. In the weeks following the first moment of that, players for the most part stood. There wasn't a whole lot of kneeling. The NFL owners this week decided not to issue a rule. They are afraid.
Right.
They don't want to. But here's my bigger question. We don't. This is so diverse. I don't know what the protests are. I get that Colin Kaepernick, when he started this, was protesting police violence against African Americans.
Yes.
I get that. The problem I think the protesters have in trying to fight back on this is we don't know who's protesting what. What are they protesting at KSU? What are they protesting at another venue where they're kneeling? And not knowing creates... I get there's police violence against black community. Is that what it's about?
There are plenty of people that are crystal clear about what this is.
I also think they're
crystal clear. There is an we've had 400 years now. We are a country, the most powerful in the world, and our wealth was built on the backs of a slave economy. All right? So that's 4 centuries. And black people with their eyes wide open, their own lived experience, the lived experience of the generations before them. You have countless people living in the North whose relatives that came up there and fathered generations of them had to leave the South in danger of their life.
Nan, don't
so
misunderstand
all of that is, all of
my
that is,
comment.
No, my point is we all...
My comment
it is not
is
a mystery at all about what this is about. There's a movement across the country
I need to respond, and I'm going to give Jackie a chance. My comment is not whether there are good reasons to protest. Everything you just said is absolutely true. I think we need to hear more after the kneeling. I want to hear the cheerleaders make a bigger statement. I want to hear the people who are kneeling come out into the community. If there are NFL players who are kneeling, I want them to talk about this so that we're all clear on why what they're doing is terribly important. Jackie, you want to weigh in on that?
No, I think you're actually both correct. I think from the senator's point of view, she understands exactly what it's about. I think in this particular instance, her understanding does not represent all of America. And I think if you look across America, I think it's very confusing, and Bill is exactly right. I think for most Americans, it's very confusing, and they're not sure. And not only that, what are they protesting, but more importantly, I think it's not about just the protest, but how do we solve it? Protests are fascinating and interesting, but unless you understand what the solution is, they don't move us forward. So I do think in this particular instance, you both have different perspectives that may both be true.
But Jim, and that's why the reason I even bring this up is I think this is what gives an opening for President Trump to declare what this is all about. These are people who are not patriotic, who hate America and hate the flag. And I think that opening is there because it would be wonderful to hear the protesters make a bigger statement.
Look, the opening is I mean, it's always been a chasm. And the NFL owners understand this. You've got 2/3 of your NFL
75% almost.
Your NFL players are African American. 80% of your viewers are white. So there is a natural fissure there to exploit, and President Trump has done that.
He's done it.
That's what it is. It's exploitation, and it's doing a false framing to deliberately confuse, to beat the patriot drum. And actually, Bill, some very eloquent players have spoken to the press.
I absolutely agree with that.
Eric, someone, you know, I'm not a big reader of the sports page, but it leaps out at you when you pick up the AJC. That's where I read it.
Jackie, you get the last word on this because we have to move on.
Yeah. So I think clearly the NFL players have a right to speak out about this. They have their own natural platforms. I do think in the NFL it's a little different because they're there for work. And so their work gets to dictate what they can and can't do. And I think the NFL owners have to think about what that means for the people that watch them. That the NFL players clearly have a right to protest, and the people that watch them clearly have the right not to watch. So I think it makes it a little more confusing.
Oh, it's a financial balancing act.
Yeah,
if you're
sure.
That's
NFL.
Exactly right.
It's a place of employment.
For the owners.
It's a place of employment. Right, it's also a place of employment for the players.
And I think it's their biggest concern, and probably rightfully so, is that most observers think the NFL is in a very, very slow, long-term death spiral, which is probably why Arthur Blank is glad he bought a soccer team.
I'll tell you, Bill. Ms. Kushner just said that these are employees, but are they employers or are they subcontractors? Because there's a difference.
Are they subcontractors?
All right.
Well, yeah.
Okay, all right. Let me put
that to be noted.
I got to move on.
Black Lives Matter is the bottom line of this.
I would love a clearer statement of that. That's all I'm asking. All right.
You don't want me to fill up your email inbox.
No, but you're not the one who's kneeling. Okay.
Now, with their comments.
We're going to take a break. Before we do, just quickly, Jim, your Politically Georgia has reported John Ossoff lost to Karen Handel. But now he's moving into the 6th District. Is it clear that means he's running against
him? I don't know. He's moved into a fairly popular place, Brookhaven. He's got an apartment there, so it could be just because it's a nice place to live.
The area where he was raised.
And it's close to where he was raised, yeah, mm-hmm.
I think he'd be smart to run again. He had a lot of name idea. He worked very hard. He raised a ton of money. I mean, he still couldn't beat her, but I think he'd be smart to run again. I don't see why he wouldn't.
Nan, do Democrats want him to be the champion of the party in the 6th?
I'm not going to attempt to speak for all Democrats, but I will point out that Handel's comments before the Kiwanis Club, she's introduced that awful 20-week ban on abortion, which has a totally distorted storyline about why that's necessary. It's not necessary. And she is up there parroting Trump on the Iran deal. A, what does she know about it? But B, that Iran deal has been certified 8 times by the UN Atomic Agency.
All right.
So she is going straight party line, far right wing, and she's vulnerable, in my opinion.
We'll see. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Samuel Bell just did. Bill Nygut still, in all caps, doesn't know what the take a knee is all about. Willful ignorance and latent white supremacy, typical. Except that critics are critics. My point is not that this isn't an important movement. My point is I would like to hear people who are involved in it talk more about it themselves.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying a lot.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, you know, whack away, folks. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Turn your radio on.
Eric Garner's death is a familiar story. An unarmed black man is killed by police. No one is charged. Journalist Matt Taibbi wanted to understand why.
Not just how these incidents happen in a few terrible seconds, but how they happen over the course of years and decades and repeat over and over and over again.
His book, I Can't Breathe, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for that conversation this afternoon from 4 to 7 on your GPB station.
Jim Galloway, let's take a quick look at another election story. over in Alabama, the Fox News is suggesting that Judge Roy Moore and Democrat, the Republican candidate, and Doug Jones may very well be in a dead heat. Now, there are polls in, within the state that don't show that, that show Roy Moore up a bit more. But, you know, Fox News sees it as too close to call.
42% to 42%. And we're still, I think that's a December 12th finish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's my question about that. Roy Moore is the extreme right-wing candidate. He's got Steve Bannon's backing. If it's possible that, first of all, can a Democrat win in one of the reddest states in the country?
They haven't since, I think, 1996. 98. Okay. 98 was the last time a statewide a Democrat won a statewide race there.
But the we had a Democratic is, governor in Alabama when I block in who it was.
Is it Seligman?
Yes, it was. Don mm-hmm. Seligman.
And
thank
he is
you.
He is in a federal prison right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
But
framed, I've been
told. The question here with Judge Moore is will your independents and more moderate Republicans be so antithetic to him that they're willing to vote for
all right.
a Democrat.
So, okay, Jackie, Roy Moore is the candidate of Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon has promised he's going to run Roy Moore-like candidates against mainstream incumbent Republicans all over the country. If Doug Jones actually can upset Roy Moore, what do we imagine that means in terms of the Steve Bannon candidates? Every state is unique, but right. does it really make you wonder whether Steve Bannon is the power broker he thinks he is?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, if you back up and look at how he got here, I mean, you know, Moore was not the candidate of choice from the White House. They were backing the current appointee. Moore came across anyway. So I think a couple of things. I think if I'm right, Jim, you'll correct me, but I think in 2016 that Alabama went 63% for Trump and 38% for Clinton.
Yeah.
So it was a big.
It was a 28-point gap.
Right. So it was a huge, it was a huge difference. So I think for them to even be, quite honestly, neck and neck should give anyone pause to think about, does it really make sense to run a far-right candidate, even in a place like Alabama? And I think clearly if he doesn't win, that they're all going to have to take a breath and think about it, which I think actually would be good.
All right. Let's move on to some political news from Washington. We had a unique situation yesterday where two previous presidents, in no way coordinating with one another, each happened to have public speaking engagements, spoke out, and both had critical comments to make about President Trump, however obliquely. Let's start with President George W. Bush, who really was surprisingly, I think, you know, whether you thought George W. was a great president or not, he kidded himself about his whether he was terribly articulate or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday in his speech, he articulated the values that he believes are important and that he thinks are being ignored and overlooked in Washington.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism. We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments, forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places. Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. People of every race, religion, ethnicity can be fully and equally American. It means that bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed.
George W. Bush, and here's President Obama, who made appearances on behalf of two Democratic gubernatorial candidates yesterday.
Folks don't feel good right now about what they see. They don't feel as if our public life reflects our best. Instead of our politics reflecting our values, we've got politics infecting our communities
You notice I haven't been commenting a lot on politics lately. But here's one thing I know. If you have to win a campaign by dividing people, you're not going to be able to govern them. You won't be able to unite them later if that's how you start.
I thought that was a really compelling statement. If you are running a campaign based on dividing, how do you bring people together to govern? And that's certainly a problem Trump is facing.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting because, this, of course, this is one of the first appearances Obama has made. He made two. And it will be interesting, to, especially to see his impact on the Virginia governor's race, whether he can actually expand that margin or not, or whether it becomes a kind of a whiplash effect among Republicans. I thought George Bush's address was more important because, of course, that was a Republican voice saying that. But here's the thing: so far we've had John McCain do this. We've had George Bush, and we've had Jeff Flake. Two of those three have nothing to lose by coming out against Trump. Jeff Flake has done that, and he's paying for it.
Yeah,
and that's
running for re-election in Arizona.
Right, that's the problem that you're seeing this. You know, the old Republican elder statesmen are saying what they need to say, but you don't see people at the congressional level, in the Georgia delegation, for instance, picking up on that message.
Jackie, we know that the Bush family has no love loss. There's no love loss for Donald Trump. He trashed Jeb Bush more than any other candidate that he faced, certainly early in the primaries last year. But that doesn't make what George W. his comments any less meaningful in many ways, does it?
Oh, not at all. And I do think both former presidents were very articulate. I would like to just take a moment and reflect. It was fascinating. Bush's words were very eloquent and they're very direct. But then you get Obama and his incredible delivery, almost as if he's preaching. I mean, just the energy and the intonation. I mean, the whole difference, I think, is really fascinating to see side by side. But I think we need to step back and I think we think about, you know, how do we get here? And it wasn't just the general, it was the primary. And I'm going to cite a poll that was taken by Chapman University earlier this year. And they asked Americans what the top fears were. And the number one fear was corruption of government officials at 74%.
Isn't that something?
Which I was shocked at, to be honest with you. Followed by number two at 55%, 20% lower for health care. And then the high medical bills were 48. So there's a huge drop-off between the biggest fear by far is political corruption, which kind of it gives you the reason kind of why we're here today. It wasn't just about, it was about the whole someone from the outside. It was about the DNC when they shoved Hillary Clinton through the primary process and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I think probably, you know, fixed the whole primary process for Clinton, gave us gave the Democrats a candidate that couldn't be voted for. So I think it's really hard for a lot of Americans out there that look from the outside and say, this is the process we have, to say, you know, I'm so scared of political corruption that I'll do anything. And that's kind of where we've gotten where we are.
All right. It's really, Nan, just so strange to see two presidents. That's a president's club. They don't often attack one another. President Carter, over the years, has been fairly blunt at times in dealing with successors.
Noted
of his.
For his candor. That's right.
But it was definitely an unusual thing to watch, I thought, yesterday. Let me just give you a few tweets, and then, Jim, I want to turn very, with the few minutes we're going to have left, to talk a bit about this awful, awful debate going on now about how a president of the United States is supposed to honor a deceased U.S. serviceman. But let me just tell you, I mean, apparently our discussion about protesters, Sidney Spangler tweets, once again, Bill Nigut is sidelining the Dem. Every time I tune in, it feels like his right-wing radio is dressed up as nonpartisan. He also says, plenty of athletes and other kneeling around the country have written very clearly about the reason behind the protest. If they have, I've missed a lot of it. Gabriel says, agreed that there should be more real discussion. Take a Knee is turning into the Ice Bucket Challenge, where ALS was forgotten. Ron Spear says, Bill's right, are NFL kneelers protesting for Black Lives Matter or to support alleged blacklist of Colin Kaepernick? Anyhow, I'm delighted that people want to talk about it. Thank you. I mean, I think debate is great on this.
Exactly.
Jim, we've had a lot of moments in the last 10 months or whatever where there's been a sense of, for me, really sadness about some of the kind of public debate that we're getting into since President Trump has taken office. Often it's been inspired by him. Sometimes it's been people who've attacked him because they can't stand him. But this debate now, which he did start over how a president is supposed to honor a deceased U.S. serviceman, is maybe one of the most, I find it so sad that we're having this debate.
Yeah, and it's to me, it's one of those, this is a really heartbreaking example of people talking past each other, I think, in many ways. First of all, I think in Donald Trump's defense, I've been very sparing in my defenses of him, he is a limited human being when it comes to vocabulary, when it comes to speaking, and when it comes to personal empathy. I think that's just the way he is programmed. And then I would also say that his business, as much money as it generates, is a very, very small operation. It's a small family operation. He has probably never made more than one or two condolence calls. And I would guess that even a state senator like the one we have in our studio, a county commissioner in Georgia, certainly a governor, has probably more experience at picking up the phone and passing on condolences upon the death of a family member. Am I right?
I
would think that you've done that before.
Oh, sure.
And many times in your official capacity. And then there's people haven't talked about it, but there is an underlying racial issue here.
That's right.
You had four U.S. troops killed in Niger. The one who was left on the ground, they had to go back for him, was black.
Yeah.
This was the husband of the woman that we're talking about.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying was when John Kelly told him not to pick up that phone, Trump did so anyway. When Trump picked up that phone, he was talking to a very small, very intimate audience, and I'm not going to fault anybody for putting it on speakerphone. Thank you very much. But that was an audience that was prepared not to like what he said. And there were certain things that Trump did that I'm sure really sparked that animus. For instance, when he did not use the soldier's name,
right?
You and I might not object to that. If you're an African American family, that means something totally different.
Oh, I think that no matter the race, you would want the President of the United States, if he's going to give you a condolence call.
But it seems something more there.
But okay. Now I got the phone call that night before any of this was national news, because I've known Frederica Wilson, the U.S. Congress lady from Florida, when she was a fellow legislator in Florida. I've known her that long, and I got the call because a member of her staff called a member of my staff, and they're old friends, and said, let me tell you what just happened in the limousine. And so I heard it secondhand from my staff, from her staff, that this just cannot be tolerated. This is unconscionable for the President of the United States to talk to the family of a fallen soldier the way he talked to her. And so I heard that before anybody had stuck a microphone under anybody's in anybody's face to get comments on it, and this would have been something that never came to light, probably in all likelihood, had it not been that there was a member of Congress in that limousine hearing that speakerphone,
Jackie,
who had the access to the media to speak up and say this is wrong.
John Kelly put himself right in the middle of this by making an appearance in the briefing room yesterday and talking very movingly about how servicemen's remains are dealt with as they're sent home. But unfortunately, he ends up as a part of this debate because he made comments about Congresswoman Frederica Wilson that were turned out to not be true. And so he becomes part of this, and which, again, for me, just makes this so sad.
I think it's incredibly sad. I think Jim, and we know Jim does not lightly take up for Trump. So I do agree with Matt. I think Trump had good intent when he called. Why else would you call someone who lost a loved one? Clearly, he was inarticulate and didn't do it in a way in which resonated with the person suffering the loss. Obviously, on retrospect, that was not I don't think that was the intent. And for John Kelly, who also lost a son, who has actually been through that, who referred to the fact is it's so incredibly hard, and I cannot imagine, so I'm not going to try to imagine. He was saying it's incredibly hard, and the president tried to express his condolences, and he tried to help. And regarding the facts around the Congresswoman, my suggestion to them was they need to slow down and make sure they have good fact checkers.
Well, let me say this. Let's not forget that this entire thing started with Trump, with it being exposed that in 12 days' time, phone calls had not been made to the families of some of those soldiers.
Yeah, I think.
And what was his response to that? Was to attack Barack Obama and other presidents and say nobody else has ever.
There's no question,
so
Jim, this was another moment in which President Trump started this all off, no matter what direction it took.
And of course, on Twitter, he was keeping it up this morning.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, there's one more disturbing thing that I think has come out of this, and this was yesterday when John Kelly, the chief of staff to the president, got before the press and announced that he was not going to take any questions from anybody, any reporter who had not served in the military or who had not lost
or didn't know a Gold Star family.
And look, this is a problem that's been long in the making. I'm happy that the draft ended 6 weeks before I turned 18. But you have this chasm developing between those who serve and those who have not served, and this is one example of that. And it can get very worrisome if you've got somebody in the White House saying that people who have not served are unworthy of asking a point.
All right, we're out of time for today's show. I mean, I would just say at the end of this, there've been lots of talk about how people follow the bright shiny objects, media certainly, others too, Democrats in responding to Trump, whatever. This is another bright shiny object, but it's such a somber and heartbreaking situation that to call it a bright shiny object feels disrespectful. But it's a debate we just really don't need, and I think probably all of us agree with that.
Well, sadly,
real quick, because we're
out of time. This president is throwing a bomb into the middle of the Middle Eastern of the Middle East. He's trying to cancel the Iran deal.
It's
a war.
I got to cut you up because we are completely out of time. Senator Nan Orrick, Jackie Cushman, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being here today. Jim and I are back on Monday at 2. Mary Margaret Oliver will be here. Chip Lake is going to be here, and we'll certainly have a lot to talk about again.
And you can ask her what she thought of Hamilton.
That's right. All right. Thank you. All of you have a great weekend. If you're listening to us in real time, I'm Bill Nigut. See you Monday at 2.